Nick Kroll and John Mulaney, author of the new book, The South Side, Natalie Moore, and live music from the local band, Meat Wave. Now here's your host, a man who is thinking about a nose ring, Justin Kaufman.
No, I'm not. But, you know, I mean, maybe like a little diamond stud. No, no, I can't. I guess maybe like a little ring. They were cute. Sterling silk. No, no. I should do it with like a feather. You know, like a little ring and then attach a feather to it. And it just kind of comes down your face. Welcome to The Download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman here on WGN Radio with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Very excited to be here. Hope you had a wonderful weekend. I did. Took the boy to C2E2 at McCormick Place. I dressed up. I was annoyed dad. Not at the characters, just at the trying to figure out how I was going to get home. Like I had a whole thing. I just turned into this neurotic just beast. Neurotic beast. That's what I went for at C2E2. All I did was just complain about, well, should I take the L? But you got to walk outside. It's kind of cold. Do I take an Uber? But we took the Uber to the auto show and they put a $5 tab. I'm like, well, you're not going to do that. Do I give a cab? But I'm mad about the 50-cent surcharge they want to put on credit. I almost walked home. I was like, I'm not letting anyone have my money. But dad, I'm having, no, you enjoy your mystery box toy that I bought for $25. It's actually great. The toy store created a frenzy by creating these like mystery boxes, almost like a huge box with a question mark on it, like Super Mario Brothers that you hit and the mushroom comes out of. And for $25 or whatever, you just buy it, and it's just crap. But that's the idea. Kids go crazy because they're like, it's a Mario question mark. It could be a mushroom. It could be anything. No, it's a leftover Doctor Who like journal. Yeah, okay, Doctor Who. Good. Anyway, we've got a great show tonight. One for the books, you guys. Coming up this hour, comedians Nick Kroll and John Mulaney are going to join me. They're in town performing their show, Oh Hello, at the Athenaeum Theater. You know these guys, Kroll from FX's The League, from his own Comedy Central hit Kroll Show. Mulaney wrote the Stefan character on SNL. He's got his own sitcom on Fox, or did. They're also the two behind Too Much Tuna. They play the characters George St. Geeglin and Gil Faison. Two New York City, West Side, Manhattan gadflies that prank people with tuna sandwiches. Look it up now. I mean, seriously, just type in Too Much Tuna on YouTube just to get ready for what's about to happen. Two comics are so funny, and Too Much Tuna is one of the best things to happen in American comedy in the last decade. Tonight, they do the interview in character. So I will be interviewing George and Gil about their show. It's kind of a dream come true. My guest at the big table tonight is the author of the book, The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. The author's Natalie Moore, and we're going to talk about what Chicago has done to keep African-Americans in the quote-unquote Black Belt from equal housing and economic opportunities. It's great. I mean, you know, I don't want to give away the tricks of the trade, but, you know, I got the book on Thursday or Friday, and I was like, oh, man, I'm gonna have to skim. You know, I'm not going to get this ready for Monday. I got to go to C2E2. And I started reading it yesterday, and I couldn't put it down. It's fascinating what has transpired in the last 50 years to keep the status quo, to keep segregation in place. A lot of powerful people making decisions that affected just one sect of our society. It's really interesting. Like I didn't know a lot of that stuff. And we'll talk to Natalie about some of the policies and politics that were behind it here in the city of Chicago. Later tonight, Charlie Meyerson's going to be here. Talk podcasting 101. What's it take to make a podcast that will get past the clutter? And if you listen to podcasts, how do you get to the next one? Because that's a problem I have. I'm always like, there's too many. It's too many. I shut down. I'm going to play that. I'm just going to play Miguel Adorn, the song. Just play it over and over because it's the first song on my phone, on my iTunes. I just don't know what to listen to. And live music from Chicago punk rockers Meat Wave. They're going to bring their gear up here in the Showcase Studio. Play some tracks. We're excited for that. And it's Monday night, so that means it's time for The Worst. Don Hall and Tyler Green from the Arts and Culture Podcast General Admission will join us to help out. You want to know what's the worst? Standing in line for the Easter Bunny. The worst. Anyone who's done that, stood in line to get a picture with the Easter Bunny. The worst. I don't care if you're a kid, a parent, an aunt, a grandma. Standing in line to take a picture with that fuzzy bunny at the mall, it's the worst. Like, there's no like, you get there, it's not like Santa Claus where you're like, oh, they're going to talk. You know, they're going to talk to Santa Claus. The kid's going to talk and say, oh, what do you want for Christmas? Oh, be a good boy, that kind of stuff, which is great. They get to meet Santa. The bunny don't talk. So you just sit there, and it's and then they have a bunch of restrictive things where they're like, you can't take a cell phone picture, you can't do this, you can't do that, and stand in line for 40 minutes, and then there's a package for $35 if you want a couple of 4x6s. God, I sound so old. I sound like a huge curmudgeon tonight, which can be great for the worst, right? All that plus news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. It's a download. I'm Justin Kaufman. The download, of course, show about Chicago, starring those who know it well. All right. Well, let's get this started. Why don't we start with the carryout? This, of course, is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. The president visited Cuba, marking the first time that a sitting president has visited this country since the 50s. So there you have it, folks. History in the making. Our president flew 4 hours to an island to say, let there be Coca-Cola. The city of Chicago is borrowing $220 million for pension payments. Come on, you know they're good for it. And if they're not, it's okay. They'll just sell something off to a private company. You've heard of red light cameras? How about red light tolls? Think about it. Every light, you pay 35 cents. Done. I should be governor. Speaking of governor, Governor Rauner's finally getting into the presidential race. If Trump wins the GOP nominee, Rauner is all in. And if Rauner can deliver Illinois to Trump in November, oh, he's going to get so many free hats and free robes and steaks and wine and gold. I mean, Rauner's going to be up to his elbows in Trump junk. Wait, that came off wrong. Mayor Emanuel's wading into some divisive waters with his latest idea. He wants to split the jogger and biker traffic on a lakeshore bike path. Always divisive. Come on, Mayor. Could you please be a unifier just once? I mean, that's why we brought you into office. Bring us together. Don't tear us apart. Chipotle, in the midst of marketing challenge due to stores having to close because of outbreaks, are now sweetening the deal, adding chips and guac to get you back in. Yep. Free chips and guac. Now, I forget that there's probably a serious problem with what Chipotle is growing to put on their plates, but chips and guac. But come on, it's a cool word. Guac is so good. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren took on Trump today, calling him not only a loser, but a bully. Trump responded by pulling her hair, gouging out the eyes of her dolly, and then saying, you know, I like you. Apple announced a new iPad today. It's got a few new wrinkles. It's going to sport better optics, tone display, and pencil support. Pencil support. Yeah, let me look that up in the manual. Oh, that's just tech for expensive. Yeah, okay. A new study says that standing desks don't really help your health. That's a bummer, because they certainly don't help with your social life. Dorks much? Ho-ho! What's up, Trump? Yeah. Me and Trump. Woo! Dorks. Lollapalooza tickets go on sale tomorrow. Let me guess who's going to headline. Red Hot Chili Peppers. There's always a 70% chance that the Red Hot Chili Peppers are going to play. Do they have something on Perry Farrell? I mean, like, did they have video of Farrell killing Natalie Wood or something? Why? Always. It's Red Hot Chili Peppers. In weather, it's the first day of spring. So stealthy nice. So you look out the window and you're like, oh, man, it's swimming weather. It's so nice. I'm going to get an Italian ice. Who needs a coat? Who needs a shirt? And then you get outside and you're like, oh, God, it's 45 degrees. That happened to me 3 times this weekend. In sports, the Sweet 16 is in, and I don't care. It's hard when nobody from the area is represented. Now, the closest is Notre Dame, but it's Notre Dame. The Lady Blue Demons made it to the Sweet 16. DePaul quietly has the best basketball program in Chicago, a few years running, but nobody seems to care. I say this is a perfect time for Chicago to rise up and get behind the Lady Blue Demons, because who else is there? I'll let you think. Right? Exactly. The NFL winter meetings take place this week in Boca, which is so funny to watch, the old rich white guys in Tommy Bahama short-sleeve collared shirts. The Bears brass is there, and there's talk that they're still in the hunt for free agent help. Come on. It's like 7 more guys. That's all I ask. Like 7 more free agents. This is the best time of the year before you guys go 7-9.
The Bulls are currently in the 8th seed by percentage points. They are in the playoffs. Just how Gar and Pax drew it up. They get the Kings tonight. Gasol is back. There you go. And finally, we are releasing carbon into our atmosphere at a rate that is faster than any time in the last 66 million years. I mean, really, people, we need to start talking about this. What? I can get free quesadillas, too? So I can get burritos, quesadillas, and chips and guac? Man, Chipotle rocks. Wait, what were we talking about again? Well, that's the carryout for March 21st, 2016. Hey, we got a first day of spring special. Yeah, it's just a burger and fries, like always, but we may open a window.
Coming up, Nick Kroll and John Mulaney join me right after the news, in character as George St. Geeklin and Gil Faison, the men behind the wildly popular Too Much Tuna. They're on stage at the Athenaeum doing Oh Hello through Thursday. It's The Download here on WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martyr, I hope you had a great weekend. How are you, bud?
I did indeed. Thank you to Wayne Mesmer of the Chicago Wolves. Had us out to the Wolves game yesterday.
Nice.
So we did. We had a lot of fun.
How are the Wolves this year?
You know what? Not as good as they have been in the past. They're about 500 right now.
They got to get it together.
They do. They do. But it was a good time.
It's better than all the college basketball, men's college basketball in the area.
I'll tell you what. The kids enjoyed Skates, the mascot. He came skating out pregame. Anytime you've got a mascot that can shoot fireworks from his paws, it's always good in the kids' book.
Note to some, writing that down.
That's right.
No, pause, fireworks. All right, good. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, two of New York's finest are bringing their wit and their style to a string of performances at the Athenaeum Theater on Southport Avenue this week up till Thursday. The show is called Oh Hello, and it's the brainchild of the writer-actor duo Gil Faison and George St. Geeklin. You may know them from their wildly successful public access prank show, Too Much Tuna, which ran in the New York area. Faison and Geeklin are about to go on stage, but before they do, they join me tonight on The Download. George, Gil, thanks for being on the show.
You're welcome.
I'm sure.
So how are you guys enjoying Chicago? Are you enjoying Chicago?
You know,
we're going to talk at
nothing.
The same time the whole time.
If that's okay, if that's good for your levels, we're going to talk at the
same time.
You'll come in
all
right
throughout
now.
The interview
right.
About
same
different
time.
Things. We're not in the same room.
Are you guys enjoying?
What was your question?
My question
what
is
was your question?
Let me ask you, Gil. Like, are you enjoying Chicago? I mean, how often do you get to the Midwest?
Oh, you know, I'm having a great time here in Chicago. This is my first time here, and it's been wonderful, just wonderful. We went and took a picture at the Big Silver Bean,
mm-hmm.
And I think we're the first people to have done that, had that idea. And the plan for the rest of the week is to go to the Wiener Circle and just get into some fun racism.
George, how about you?
Absolutely. I come to the Midwest orphan. For my health, I go to Flint for the waters, to the spas of Flint, and I soak in the water, and it strengthens me. It makes me metal. But I come to Chicago, and I'll tell you why. I placed a bet, a very impulsive bet with Michael Jordan, 10 years ago. I told him that it's difficult to use the bathroom at a supermarket. He said, I bet you $2 million it's not. Very impulsive. And so I come to the area and I try to collect from Mike, but you know MJ, he does not pay his gambling debts.
No, he does not. Yeah, that's the one thing you do know about him. You guys are primarily known for television with Too Much Tuna. Why make the transition to the theater?
Would you like to go back to the Michael Jordan topic, or did you want to see the movie?
We could.
I can't.
I guess we can go back to Michael Jordan.
Let's keep the analogy going. You know, obviously we were known, we're rock stars, all stars, some say Hall of television and pranks and things of this nature. But every once in a while, you got to shake things up. You got to leave professional basketball and go play minor league baseball for a year because, you know, you want to try something new. And because your gambling debts have become such a major issue, that they have to get you out of your profession so that there isn't too much inquiry into what's happened with your life. And that's what we've done with the stage, the move to the theater. It's like our move to baseball. We're worse at it. It's an unimpressive showing, but our natural abilities allow us to pretend that we're worth our time.
It's a not self-imposed exile into a worse form, but we'll charge people a lot. And we're extremely comfortable with that.
And by the time we make it back to TV, our chosen profession, you know, we'll lost a step. And then we'll get into management and general managing and probably create some of the worst television teams in the history of the sport.
Well, that's a good plan. You got long term there. You guys don't seem like theater guys. Are you guys getting used to the jargon and the rules of the stage?
How dare you? How dare you say we don't seem like theater people? We are the most theater something can be. We wear the most wet wool. We're the most fussy. And we love an arts and leisure section. We pour through it to see what types of irrelevant dance is happening. The theater and us are conjoined.
We want to go twins. Like Siamese twins, and we're the gangly one. And we love Steppe Wolf. You know, we are Sinise heads to the end. And, you know, we're excited about being, you know, in Chicago, which is a wonderful theater town with a great tradition of it, you know?
Yeah. We're talking with George St. Eaglin and Gil Faison. Their show, Oh Hello, is at the Athenaeum Theater running through Thursday. You know, you made your name on Too Much Tuna, the wildly successful prank show that was on New York One for a while. Talk about where you came up with this idea, because it really was groundbreaking.
Well, to be fair, we made our names as aliases when we escaped to Canada during something called the Vietnam War. But we made our reputations, I guess, is what you're saying, with pranks.
Yes, yes.
And it was it's a funny story, actually. Years ago, we used to drink tuna teenies.
Yeah, that's a tuna-based martini.
Otherwise known as the Martuna.
But, you know, known within the lesbian community as the Martuna Navratilova.
The point is, we drank fish. And one day, the drinks were a little messed up. And Gil said to the bartender, "There's too much tuna in my tuna teeny, but your Martuna needs more tuna," and we laughed over it.
Yeah, and, you know, and we submitted that to the Torker, the Time, and the New Yorker magazine, and they canceled our subscription.
So then, two ideas at once, too much tuna, and then our basic dislike and disregard for everyone we see on the sidewalks. So we thought, what if we could just pummel people and humiliate them with this too much tuna that's now kind of in the zeitgeist.
Right.
And it really came together, and it's pretty much one of the most beloved things in the United States of America currently.
You guys did it on New York One. Talk about that, because it's that's not necessarily public access, but it's similar.
New York One is like, it's better than cable access, but worse than regular TV. You know, we are on WGN, is that right?
That's right.
So you might understand.
I think I know where you're going, yeah. you know, obviously you guys getting on stage and touring and coming to the Midwest and putting together a string of shows, you got to be concerned about, you know, staying healthy. Obviously there you've had health risks and concerns. I know, Gil, you know, mm-hmm. you were diagnosed with mercury poisoning. And with the tuna recall that was out last week, I mean, how do you guys stay fit and ready to do this show with all the sort of health concerns surrounding you guys?
Yeah, what we've done, though, is, you know, maintaining our, you know, we've been eating the Fukushima tuna, you know, the tuna from from around the Japanese, you know, nuclear spill. And that's that good radiated tuna. And that acts like a superpower.
So whenever there's a recall or a shortage of the American tuna, we turn to the Fukushima supply. And it strengthens us.
Mm-hmm. It acts almost like when that Peter Parker got stung by that spider when he became Spider-Man. And that nuclear spider, you know, and that's what tuna is for us. And so now you know, if I get amped up, I'll scale right up a wall, you know.
It's like canned spinach to papaya, which he would drink to get a big arm to save Miss Skinny from Fatso, from Fat Monster.
Right. Gil, have you cut back on tuna? I mean, when the doctor said, you know, this is harmful, I mean, did you guys take that into consideration?
No, I would say that doctor, this is the time we were not seeing Dr. Wong, who is our doctor for everything. This is when we got placed with this other doctor. And that's for sure a product of Big Clam. You know, Big Clam's always trying to get their different ideas into the public. But it's, you know, I doubled down, in fact. I doubled down on my tuna consumption.
More.
You know?
Yeah, okay.
We realized the big hospitals are working with the pharmaceutical companies and the boneless sardine and warder companies to discredit tuna. And it's this Obama, and he's a disappointment.
And that is entirely based underlyingly on his race. And we don't talk about that much.
You don't usually get political, but you are doing a show in a political time. It's political season. We just had the primary here. Do you guys get involved in presidential politics?
Oh, sure. We've been lobbying very hard for Dukakis. And, you know, it's exciting. It's an exciting time, you know. Cruz still in the race, and he's really doing God's work, literally. And you know, George, what would you say Ted Cruz looks like?
You know, the thing about Ted Cruz, with all the stress, he still looks so good. He looks like the whole movie Dick Tracy pushed together into one face. It's a face that can't agree on what it is, and I love the yin and the yang of the face. It's fat, it's pointy, it's everything.
I thought you guys would be Bernie Sanders guys because you knew him from back when.
Oh, sure. You know
who? What?
Bernard. Talking about Bernard.
Our friend Bernard?
Yes, our friend Bernard. They know him as Bernie. Bernie's running for president.
He's going by Bernie. What's he running for president of, the Band-Aid on Forehead Society?
No, he's running for president of the United States.
Bernard from the handball court.
Yes, Bernie, little Bernie. He's running for president of the United States, and he's doing great, actually.
Gil, you're breaking up a little. Are you in your metal bathtub again?
Yeah, I'm in a metal bathtub. I got to get all the demons out by the time we do our show.
It's a type of aversion therapy that Dr. Wong recommends.
Yeah, I sit in a metal tub filled with wood balls, and I roll around until all the demons leave my head.
That sounds therapeutic.
In closing, with you asked this politically.
Yeah.
We hope there's a broken convention where, you know, all the screens are broken, and we believe that Marco Rubio looks like an adult altar server, and we are staunch Dukakis heads, and also we are not registered to vote.
You guys, as New Yorkers, you guys have lived on the Upper West Side of Manhattan for better part of a half a century. Geez, how has it changed for you guys? I mean, how has your neighborhood changed? There's been a lot of gentrification, a lot of changes in the neighborhoods of New York City. How has the Upper West Side changed since you've lived there?
It's changed so much. I mean, when we first moved there, you know, it had that feel of like the awning outside the apartment on Sinfeld. And now so many changes, so many administrations. It feels like the awning on the outside of Paul Reiser's apartment on Mad About You.
That's right. You know, and I know that, you know, New York's not the only city that's changed over the years. You know, Chicago's really changed. And ever since we lost Mayor Daley, I know George is passionate about that, and it's been tough, you know.
You mean the original Mayor Daley or the son?
The son, who so grew into looking like the original that I applaud him.
Right.
You know, there's many great exits in history. Lou Gehrig obviously saying, "I'm the luckiest man on the face of the earth," and for Mayor Daley to privatize the parking meters on his way out. Just as a last thank you to the people of Chicago, I admire it. I admire a small, short-sighted move at the end of a long career.
George St. Eaglin, Gil Faison, they are the duo, the actor-writer duo, which I did not know that one, you know, that Gil, you're an actor, and George, you're a writer. That's exciting.
right? That's how did you guys get together? When you started doing this, did that come out, or is that how you guys got together? That you're both actor and writer.
We met at Columbia University in the late '60s. I was there as a trespasser.
I was a student, part of a rarely discussed thing called the anti-war movement.
Right.
And we would play frisbee and stare at blondes and brunettes. And in this way, we ended the Vietnam War. And anyway, that's where I met Gil.
All right.
And then we developed our artistic passions together, you know, Muse and Muselix.
All right, Gil Faison.
Very, very tinny, cheap jazz.
George St. Gieglin, Gil Faison, they're the stars of the show Oh Hello, which are at the Athenaeum Theater through Thursday, the Athenaeum up on Southport Avenue. Guys, I can't thank you enough for taking some time out. Have a great show tonight.
All right, John, I'm sure.
Thank you so much. Korfman, thank you.
Gil Faison and George St. Gieglin are my guests here on The Download. How fun is that? For those who didn't hear the setup to that, and there were a lot on the text that came in, get these guys off the air. Who do they think they are? It was Nick Kroll and John Mulaney. Both they're doing Oh Hello, the show Oh Hello at the Athenaeum Theater in character for about 90 minutes. You saw it last night,
yeah,
right, Pete?
Yeah, it was amazing.
They just come out and they do that for 90 minutes?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so great.
It's so good.
They kind of joke about it, but I mean, that bit, which was on the Kroll show, the first Oh Hello, Too Much Tuna. And I'm telling you, go to YouTube, just put in Too Much Tuna and have some fun tonight. There's some great stuff. Some of the best stuff. I mean, when that was just took a it really did take the country by storm. And now they're T-shirts. I see people wearing T-shirts.
It's, yep, like,
Too Much Tuna. You've been pranked. So good,
that
right?
So good.
So it's awesome that they did that in character.
Yeah,
they seem to like it. They seem to have fun.
Yeah, yeah. That's the one takeaway I had from seeing that show is they seemed like they were having so much fun on stage doing those characters. They were kind of like cracking each other up, even coming up with, you know, some ad libs and whatnot. But yeah, I think there is probably tickets still available for some of the shows later in the week.
Well, there you go.
If you like that.
Well, we got the show off tomorrow. Maybe I'll go up there tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah, you should.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Thanks for being here. Today, news broke that housing prices in the Chicago area are on the rise. But even without looking at the study or the report, I can guess that not all housing in Chicago is on the rise. In some of Chicago's African-American neighborhoods, today's news may be about a different town, a different country, a different planet. No growth, no increases, no housing. A new book out tomorrow explores Chicago's sordid past with race, segregation, housing, and development. It's called The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. It's a must-read for anyone who's curious about the makeup of the city and why it boasts unique data that sets it apart from major cities when it comes to segregation. It covers the Great Migration, restrictive covenants, white flight, public housing, and the plan for transformation. And it raises some interesting questions not only about who we are as a city, but who's responsible for segregation in Chicago. The author's Natalie Moore. She's the South Side Bureau Reporter for Chicago's NPR member station. She's also been published in the Chicago Reporter, the Chicago Sun-Times, Chicago Tribune. She grew up in Chatham, and she currently lives in Hyde Park, and she's my guest tonight at the big table. Natalie, great to see you.
I'm so happy to be reunited with you.
We've been together for a long time. I was telling Pete, you know, and the audience in the first hour that, you know, this was one of those things where I was like, I got the book from you guys, like, maybe on Thursday or Friday, and I was like, all right, I'm just going to skim through it. I'll just look at the pictures and I'll just throw out chapter heads. But I really did. I mean, I really got hooked on this in the last 2 days just because
it connected
the dots to me to a lot of what I know about Chicago and I didn't know, specifically the history of housing and housing patterns. Why don't we start with the Great Migration? Because we just had Danny Davison here talking about the Great, coming here from the Great Migration, settling up on the West Side. But this is, I mean, there was this sort of idea that the Great Migration was this this movement to Chicago, to the North, for freedom, for a new day. And Chicago wasn't necessarily ready for it.
Right. So this is actually the 100th anniversary of the Great Migration. Between 1916 and 1970, 500,000 blacks came from the South up here. And three of my grandparents were part of that. And overall, the Great Migration, 6 million blacks left the South to go north. And, you know, it wasn't just, you know, freedom and jobs. They were often fleeing racial violence. So, I mean, my grandparents came here. They weren't fleeing that. But on my dad's side, relatives in Nashville, two of my grandfather's brothers had to leave, or they might have been lynched. One was accused of raping a white woman, and he didn't. Another one got into a fight with some white boys, and they chased him down. And so, like, they had to, like, leave town. And then you had people who didn't want sharecropping. The Chicago Defender was very influential in that. You know, that paper was
in here, right?
Yeah, Eitan Michaeli's book on the history of the Chicago Defender. It was banned in the South, but Pullman porters, and my grandfather was a Pullman porter. He didn't work the South route, but they would drop off like bundles of paper, those papers, and saying you should come north, there's jobs, etc. So, you know, one of my chapters is called Jim Crow in Chicago. And, you know, Northern racism is different from Southern racism. And yes, there was a lot of opportunity here, but then Chicago and other northern cities said, well, what do we need to do to contain this black population?
Migration coming to Chicago, and it's not this thought of you can go anywhere you want, you want in Chicago. There was specific laws in place that were put together that said these are the neighborhoods, these are the blocks, this is where you can live, and you can't live anywhere else.
Right. So the Black Belt, which people may remember from Richard Wright's Native Son, you know, that's what they called it. They also called it Bronzeville, Black Metropolis. You know, it was a vibrant place. A lot of, you know, culture was born. I mean, Chicago was forever changed because of the Great Migration. But then as more blacks were coming, it got overcrowded, and you had tenement type housing, and you had policies here on the books, and you also had national policies in the Supreme Court saying, you can do this.
Everybody knows that the Supreme Court struck down the covenants in 1948. But before that, there was a couple times that they ruled in favor of it. They said, hey, you know what? Yeah, no, the way it's working. And when you say it was overcrowded for African-Americans. I mean, the city wasn't, you know, three times its size.
Exactly.
It was only saying the blocks that they were allowed to live on were double, triple the size they should have been. And the city was not allowing people to live in different parts.
Right. And then the covenants said that you couldn't sell or rent to a black family. And then you had institutions like the University of Chicago enforcing that. And when I was writing this book, I thought this was going to be stating the obvious. But so many people I found out didn't know that. Everybody knows, well, most people know that Lorraine Hansberry, who wrote Raisin in the Sun, is from Chicago. Right. But her family's story was the inspiration for that play. Her family moved to West Woodlawn, which was white, in around 1940. Well, no, it was in the 1937. And the case was called Hansberry versus Lee. Anna Lee was a woman, white woman who lived in the neighborhood, who said, you shouldn't have sold to this family. And they threw rocks. Lorraine Hansberry's mom had to walk around with a gun. Yep. To protect the family, and they had to move. The case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the covenant was struck down, not because it was discriminatory, but because they technically did not have enough white homeowners to sign.
There's always a technicality. Yeah. But it was struck down.
But it was still a win, because then West Woodlawn opened up to blacks by 1940.
And we're gonna take a break in a second here, and when we come back, I want to talk about what happened after the covenants were struck down. But what I thought was interesting is the role that the University of Chicago and Hyde Park played, because we all know that neighborhood to be almost progressive, and it really is this sort of like utopia kind of vibe with the university. But they argued for covenants. They said this was actually a good thing for black communities, because you could set up communities, you could have pride in your space. This was the idea.
Right, like, no, this is good for black people.
Yeah, right.
We should keep them separate.
That was
exactly.
A big argument for them. I mean, it's amazing to think that Hyde Park and the University of Chicago, as we know them now, were at the forefront of that argument against getting rid of the covenants.
Mm-hmm.
Natalie Moore is the author of The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. When we come back, we'll talk about post-covenants, which doesn't get much better.
It doesn't get better.
And then public housing. We got the whole hour here. We're going to talk with Natalie here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight, Natalie Moore, the author of The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. She's my guest all hour here at the big table. Before the break, we're talking about the restrictive covenants. These were shot down by the U.S. Supreme Court on the technicality, essentially. But it opened it up, right?
Well, with Lorraine Hansberry's family in 1940. Yeah, right. And then in 1948, Shelley versus Kramer struck them down in a more comprehensive way.
Yeah. So 1948. And this is really sets the table for Chicago to do something, because the covenants made it where you know that African Americans only go in certain spots.
Right.
And now they open it up, and it was up to the policymakers and politicians and just capitalism, the idea that anyone can live anywhere. And it didn't go necessarily according to plan, mostly because of what we all know now as the concept of white flight.
Right. So if you look at neighborhoods, I mean, and it's probably very hard for people to imagine neighborhoods like Roseland, Chatham, Inglewood, Auburn Gresham, South Shore, were all white. If you look at the 1950 census and then you look at 1960,
it's like a world of difference.
They change. I mean, I've even heard people, I grew up in Chatham, and some elders I know who live in the community are like, yeah, white people like were packing their stuff in the middle of the night. Like, they were, white flight is not just a fanciful term. It is.
It's a panic.
It was a literal term. And there was nothing in place to try to prevent that. So you had block busting and panic peddling, and you had unscrupulous realtors.
That's
who,
what I was going to say. What I know about that term, and I know about the history of it because I've had relatives involved in it, and we've known Chicago from doing the stories. But what was interesting in your book was about how, and you can think about it now, that this was almost a panic that was started by the real estate community, this idea where there seemed to be some benefit for real estate, for speculators, for others to be able to go, yeah, you should leave. You should leave now because it's such, you know, and
it's going to turn.
It's going to turn. And, yeah, it, you know, just get what money you can now. And then they could turn around and they sell the property for more.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what was happening in the 50s and causing this huge thing that changed the face of the way we live in the city.
So you had a few things that were going on. One, you know, white families who were scared the neighborhood was changing, and then the realtors
are whispering in the air,
capitalizing off of that. So they might, a realtor could come in and sell a property or buy a property cheap from a white family that wants to leave, and then in turn sell it high to a black family. Or they would do things like hire black people to act kind of crazy or, you know, so-called ghetto up and down the street. So then white families would say, oh, I don't want to live here. And also during this time, you had redlining. So blacks weren't, when was the black belt, blacks weren't getting loans because they had the color, you know, under the, you know, Federal Housing Administration, they weren't able to get loans. So you have that dynamic. And then you have the government saying, you know what, we're going to support white flight. Home ownership is the cornerstone of, you know, middle class wealth in this country. And so you had the government building suburbs post-World War II, and loans were being favored in the suburbs. And these suburbs were white, and you also had the government saying, and, you know, we're going to build expressways to help you. So it wasn't like white families were leaving for other Chicago neighborhoods. It was an, you know, for the most part, it was a mass exodus to the suburbs. And so, you know, even though this book is called The South Side, you know, that's where I'm focusing on. I mean, this is a regional story, and people who, you know, lived to the moved to the suburbs, you know, they say good schools or, you know, quality of life. They say all these things, and, you know, I'm, you know, people have the,
they're just buzzwords.
Kind of, but I mean, I think it's also important for families to understand the history about why they could go to some of these suburbs. Like, this was subsidized, like, heavily subsidized for you to get there. And then you have, you know, the expressways that have to be built, the roads that have to be built, water
so
to
get
out there.
So a lot of money went into expanding,
yes,
to for at the at the for white people to move to the suburbs.
Right. One taxpayer thing, money. Yes.
What I thought was interesting too, thinking about the way that, you know, you broke it down, that when the covenants were lifted, the people who moved to the white neighborhoods that are in question, when you talk about like hiring somebody to run up and down the street, the people that were moving were people who had means to move. they were moving. There were middle-class black families that wanted to move up, just as the American way. They said the next step, you know, now we've got a family, we're moving to this, to Roseland. We're moving to the pit, you know, we want a driveway and a house. It wasn't this sort of concept in Chicago stereotype that it was poor people just coming in and driving values down. This was a pretty obvious thing that was happening, and history has almost like changed the way we've looked at it.
Right. So my grandparents came mostly after the war, and you know, so they weren't, so those first wave of African Americans who moved into those changing neighborhoods were often met by violence. So my grandparents lived first in Woodlawn, but then in Park Manor. Park Manor was white. In 1949, the first black family moved to a block, and 2,000 white rioters came out and like firebombed their house. So there are so many instances of violence in the city trying to cover up, the Human Relations Commission asking the Tribune not to report on it, asking other outlets not to report on it. So with my grandparents moving to Woodlawn, and then the other set living in Princeton Park, which was rental, but then they moved to Burnside, which was changing over. That's on the south side, too. You know, they had, you know, my grandfather worked for R.R. Donnelly. My grandmother worked in a kitchen in CPS. My other grandparents, the Pullman porter, secretary for the federal government. You know, black women were working. You know, these weren't stay-at-home moms. And they were able to, you know, buy two flats, buy houses. And, you know, the legacy, despite all these obstacles, you know, Chicago, you know, just had miles upon miles of black middle class and working class neighborhoods. And that's significant to note, too, that these were not just, and the property values went down. It wasn't because it is racial, but it's not something inherently bad with black people. It's how the industry sees them. And that data still holds forth today. You know, black middle class equals lower white middle class.
That's the equal, yeah.
And if you own, you know, black neighborhoods have lesser value than white neighborhoods. And that's because the house is less. It's because how the lending industry has chosen to look at this. And this resonates. And we're talking about history, but, you know, history dictates how we see things today. And during the housing boom and then crisis, I mean, Lisa Madigan suing Bank of America Countrywide, predatory loans. I mean, banks were specifically going into black neighborhoods and say, we're going to give bad loans. You know, there's plenty of data to show that. And even a neighborhood like Chatham, you know, that was one of the neighborhoods that got hit with bad loans.
There's so much in this book about housing and where we live in the city of Chicago, you know, whether it be the north side, the south side. The book is called The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. We're going to take a break for the news. When we come back, the two things that I want to talk about, public housing. I mean, it's so interesting because it really should be public housing and Mayor Daley's. The
right.
way that the
Both
two Daley's
yes.
worked. I mean, because they were mayor for 50 years, and you know, like to combined.
Yeah.
I mean, and they made decisions on public housing and the way that the Chicago Housing Authority operated that were not the greatest decisions.
To put it mildly. Yeah.
And the other thing, too, which I think is such a takeaway, is that, you know, one thing you take out of this book is that everybody hates poor people. And that's you mentioned that over and over in this book about there really is a stigma towards people who don't have money. I mean, we create stereotypes. We do a lot of different things to almost demonize the poor. And it shows in even some of the policy decisions that are made by some of our sitting senators and representatives today.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole part. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about public housing and how everybody hates the poor coming up on the download here on WGN. Stay with us. Yeah, it's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we're playing the worst. You know what's the worst?
No.
Closed moths. Moths. You ever had moths?
No.
I had these little moths that are now like in my little front room. They're the worst. They don't do anything. They're idiot bugs. They don't do anything. They just sit there and I'm like, you're not even like eating anything. You're not doing anything. Get out of my house. That's coming up on the worst, 9:30. We'll talk with Don Hall and Tyler Green from the Arts and Culture Podcast General Admission will be my guests on The Worst. And then coming up later, the band Meat Wave, punk rock band, will be in studio performing live. Right now, Natalie Moore is my guest. She's the author of the book, The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. It comes out tomorrow.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You've been working on this for a while.
Yeah, a few years.
Yeah, right? I mean, does it feel good to be at the end of it where, you, I mean, tomorrow's the day. I mean, you're going to just party all day. What are you going to do?
Well, considering that I'm like almost 9 months pregnant, I don't know how
much. You can be a pregnant party. I mean, you can do a little ginger ale party. But are you, do you have like everything lined up now to do like a bunch of book release parties
so
and stuff like that?
Tomorrow is the book release party, and that's at Parkway Ballroom in Bronzeville from 7 to 9. On Saturday, I'll be in Forest Park at Centuries and Sleuths Bookstore. And March 30th, I'll be at Columbia College. March 31st, University of Chicago. April 8th, Northeastern Inner City Studies Campus.
Yeah, here it comes. Here comes it. Now we start putting bets on when you're actually going to give birth. So
I don't have anything after April 8th. The baby's due April 21st. And then then I pick back up May 15th. This baby just will be slung to me.
As you've said before, this is your other baby, the South Side.
Right, two All babies right. birthed a month apart.
So let's talk about the big part of this book is about public housing as well. In 1962, the Robert Taylor Homes came out. And this was really the brainchild of Richard J. Daley, who, mm-hmm. you know, who really believed in this housing. They pitched it as this beautiful way that they're going to have public housing in the rows along the Dan Ryan. This was the beginning of public housing as we kind of know it in Chicago was 1962.
Right. Well, there had been public housing before, but these high rises. I mean, we had Cabrini, we had Ida B. Wells, but Robert Taylor and Stateway were in Bronzeville, the Black Belt, and again, with housing policy, white aldermen made sure that they weren't getting any public housing in their ward. So on one hand, these high rises were seen as a welcome because they replaced some of that old tenement, rickety kitchenette housing that was substandard in the Bronzeville area. These were high rises that had elevators and they were new and it was seen as a new wave. But again, they were contained, so you replaced one type of tenement and put another type of tenement housing in.
One of the things I found interesting about the facts and figures around public housing is when people say when those high-rise public housing, you know, we talk about Robert Taylor Home and Stateway Gardens, even Cabrini Green to an extent, went bad. You know, went to there was a lot of finger pointing and you know, a lot of times you point at the poor. You point at the people who live in there. But there was a distinct change that was made at one point from HUD, that changed the way that public housing was done. They said it's not just for people who, you know.
Yeah, we had working families living in
public. It used to be working
families,
right. And they changed the requirements for rent. They said we're going to bring it down. And that's really when you start to see a different kind of public housing.
They said we need to house the poorest of the poor. And so that shift made it less of transitional housing, and then you had, I mean, you were kind of penalized if you were a married couple and you were maybe on public assistance and there was a man in the house. Like it was, so you saw this switch from being two-parent households to female-headed households because the policies really supported that more. And then you had just outright neglect of the buildings, and when,
which was tied to that because they brought the number of dollars it took to rent at public housing down, so there was less money that was coming in for repairs, not to mention neglect and other
things. So you have, you know, a hyper-segregated housing already in a hyper-segregated community. And the upkeep wasn't good. You didn't have resources. You know, these really were, I mean, on one hand, it was a visible sign of poverty and poor people because you could see it on the Dan Ryan. And then on the other hand, you know, this was, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, were you warehousing the poor? This is bad. You know, these were still communities. You know, there are a lot of conflicting ideas, you know, particularly among residents. You know, I just always think that this is still deliberate, that Richard J. Daley said, I'm not going to build public housing in white areas.
Yeah, because
white
you think
aldermen
of New York,
don't.
I think of New York City and Manhattan.
I was going to say that.
It's like known that, you know, block to block, there's going to be a percentage of public housing. Chicago decided to go in a different route. Mayor Richard J. Daley was really at the helm there, where he said, "No, I got a better idea. High rises down the old Black Belt, when that, and right next to the Dan Ryan Expressway, and that'll solve all our problems."
Right. And the other thing that, you know, even I've challenged myself on, like, we were really fed here that high rises are bad.
Right.
That is not how you house people. And we have high rises all and down.
Right behind us.
You know, right behind us, Lake
Michigan.
There's
11 of them right here. Right.
And then going south. And like you said, New York has high rises. I mean, high rises can be successful. So there's been a lot of pointing like, oh, you can't high rise poor people. You can't have high rises. And that's not it. You can't not have resources.
Right.
And you shouldn't isolate communities like that.
Now, you mentioned you grew up in Chatham.
Yes.
And this is a big part of your book, too, about stereotypes, about the idea that people think to the Southside communities that were ravaged by white flight as, you know, it's just poor people took over. And that's not the case. There was a sprawling and very robust Black middle class that lived in Southside neighborhoods. And then there also, you know, being in Chatham, there was this stereotype of what was on the other side of, I guess it would be State Street, right? The idea of what was happening in these high rises. And there was a segregation between the Black middle class and what was happening.
For public housing, I would say yes. But, you know, Black middle class neighborhoods are also not isolated the way white middle class neighborhoods are. You know, Black neighborhoods have multi-apartment dwellings. There's closer proximity to poverty and urban ills than you have in white neighborhoods. So you're not completely in a bubble when you're in a Black middle class neighborhood. That doesn't mean that, you know, I had friends or that I was going to visit Robert Taylor, but you also navigating the South Side as a Black kid, you see a lot. You aren't just, you know, these aren't gated communities because they don't want to be gated communities either.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a big part of the book, too, about interviewing. You had a chance to interview some people who lived in Robert Taylor or Stateway, and the automatic knee jerk is, oh, they probably want to get out.
Yeah. You know, when I moved back here and I was doing this was 10 years ago, and doing a piece for the Chicago Reporter about the history of Robert Taylor Homes, and the last tower was coming down. And so I went, and I mean, it's not a pleasant place to look. I mean, at this point, it's really deteriorated. The elevators aren't working. It smells in the elevators. You know, it just wasn't, it didn't seem pleasant to me. But what I learned from that interviewing a woman is that this is still home. Like, somebody could have come to many places that I have lived and been like, you, like, this is not worthy of my maid. Like, you know, this tiny condo, right. You know, we all make judgments, and the sense of home is very strong, and you never want people to take away your home, even, you know, as painful as it could be. So, you know, once I saw, I mean, I quickly, you know, we all bring subjectivity. We're not objective. We try to be fair. But I quickly learned that that wasn't the story, that this wasn't people like, yeah, I'm so glad these towers are coming down. And, you know, that just informed how I went forward with my reporting.
Let me ask you this, because this is a big part of the book about, you know, I mentioned stereotypes and falsities, things like that. The plan for transformation, which, I mean, really is still ongoing, that was,
yes,
is brought out in 1999 by Richard M. Daley.
Yeah, and this is the plan to tear down the high-rises, right, mixed-income communities, remake, right, public housing.
And it's still lagging. They're still not finished, right, with it. It's 2016. But one of the things that gets thrown out there, and you address this in the book, is that one of the theories about why Chicago has gun violence, why there's, you know, crime, and we're seeing, and your book dispels that notion, but the idea that this perceived uptick in violence is because the people who lived in the housing projects were spread out into Southside communities like Inglewood or Auburn Gresham, mm-hmm, or others like that. Mm-hmm. And that's what sort of, that element is what caused the uptick in violence.
Right. I mean, that's way too simplistic. What I found more so, well, there's data also that shows that that's not true. Now that doesn't mean there hasn't been any instability in some neighborhoods with public housing residents coming to live on their vouchers. I see it as more of quality of life issues than just straight violence. So, you know, if you live in a high rise concrete building, you don't have a backyard, you may not know that it's not okay to barbecue on the front lawn. You may not know that people tend to congregate in their backyards rather than on their front porches. So there was some cultural adjustments that happen. And then there are stereotypes with, you know, Section 8, those are the voucher people. I was at a community meeting once in Chatham, and they had a CHA representative there. And he said, you know, most of the calls that I get complaining about Section 8, I look up the address and it's not a Section 8.
So everybody just assumes it is. That's a big thing in the neighborhood. If there's some trouble, they go, someone should check with the landlord because that's probably Section 8.
Right.
And that's not necessarily the case.
No. But, you know, again, you have new neighbors adjusting. The other thing that you had was so much crime took place on public housing property, not because of the residents, but these are neglected areas. So drug dealers had a place to ply their trade. They were open air drug markets. And then once you tore down those high rises, you had a dispersed drug market as well. So you have people going into new turfs and there was conflict there. Again, that doesn't mean these are public housing residents. It just means like this open air drug market has been demolished. And so now where do you go?
A lot of you know, I mentioned at the break just about the idea that everybody hates poor people, right? Mm-hmm. But there's this feel in the book where it comes back to that. It is about race. And it is about class to a certain extent. But segregation, as mentioned by someone at the end of the book, just you mentioned that segregation, to call out segregation, say that's the problem, say that segregation itself caused it. That the reason there's segregation is because there's no resources, because it's not right. Equal in the disbursement of everything from, you know, housing funds to capital, capital improvements. All the kind of things that go along with segregation is really what's causing the problem. And we can't really fix that until we really find a way to invest into some of the neighborhoods you're talking about.
That's pretty much my thesis of the book. You summed it up, that we're going to continue to be a city of inequities until we address segregation and these inequalities.
For you, I mean, you're a lifelong Chicagoan. You left for a little bit, but you came back. You grew up in Chatham. One of the great things about this book is, you know, there's a great passage where you explain what you did and, you know, like growing up and talked mm-hmm. about your life and it's very suburban and even in the city's kind of cityscape. You know, what do you think of this city? I mean, you covered from the South Side. You see a lot of pain, but you also grew up here and you got a lot of pride. What's your take on Chicago?
Well, I mean, one thing that I wanted to say, and this may make me seem like I'm contradicting myself, you know, there's a difference between self-selection and segregation. So on one hand, I'd support Black institutions. I went to historically Black college. You know, I don't look at that as segregation. I mean, it started because of segregation, but it has, you know, a great legacy. You know, I support Black arts in this city. You know, but that doesn't mean that I support segregation. But I also didn't want to, in the book, paint Black communities or Black people as bad that need white fixing.
Yeah, right.
This isn't about, you know, kumbaya, we need white people to be better. And I wanted to show the beauty of Black neighborhoods, that what it was like to grow up in Chatham. And despite all the great things about the neighborhood, those families are still at a disadvantage if they're choosing to build their wealth through home ownership. And
which is how most Americans have done it in the past.
So there's a Black woman who's a law professor at Emory, who I quote, who's done so much research on just the value of Black neighborhoods being low. And she's saying, I'm not telling you not to buy in a Black neighborhood. I'm not demeaning Black people or Black places. in that it's okay to buy, but just make sure you diversify your money because the system is rigged against you. The system is going to say this is worth less. The system says the wider a neighborhood, the more money you get. And if you, you know, drive around a lot of Southside neighborhoods, you'll see a beautiful housing stock. You know, we're not talking about, I wrote this in the book. I remember being at McGill for grad school, and we did, for a public policy class in journalism, we did a tour. And the professor let me narrate part of it. And we had gone through Bridgeport, which, you know, has an older housing stock. It's not, I mean, the bigger houses are the ones that people have built from the ground up. And then we drove around a place like Chatham. And then I was the only black person in the class. And the white people said, oh, wow, this area is nicer than Bridgeport, because they couldn't believe that a black neighborhood could look more affluent or be nicer than a white neighborhood.
Well, Chicago South Side has a tremendous amount of history and architecture. And I mean, we mentioned the housing stock. I mean, Roseland. I mean, you mentioned in the book just how Roseland is, you know, there are Tudors and driveways and the whole, I mean, stuff that you're not going to see in Lincoln Park and you're not going to see in Wicker Park. It's a whole different kind of neighborhood. And it's just for some reason, there's just a lot of people just don't recognize.
Right. I mean, look at South Shore. There are houses that are on the lake. There's this one house. We have a picture of it on WBEZ. I swear, this family decided to build a South Beach house on the lake because everything else is a bungalow. And here's like this sleek, modern building. And then you have the Jackson Park Highlands, which I think have like some of the prettiest houses in the city. So there, yeah. You know, there is this richness that is there. And it's not, you know, tenement housing. It's not poor people.
Natalie Moore is the author of The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. The book comes out tomorrow. We didn't even talk about Beverly. There's so much in this book to sink your teeth into if you're a fan of Chicago history, but also want to know about the city that you live in currently. Great job, Natalie. And thanks for being my guest tonight on The Big Table. Hey, it's The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's the halfway mark of the show tonight. My next guest knows a thing or two about radio. Charlie Meyerson has spent a life, because you've done other things.
I've had several lives. One of them
was in radio, reading the news at WXRT and running the newsroom here at WGN Radio. It's good to be back. It's first time back?
First time back in
a
while.
Serious? Wow.
Yeah.
I brought you back in?
You did.
I'm so ignorant.
You're one of the few people I've come back
from. Exactly.
No, I've come back for anybody.
The whole management team is seething right now. How do you let him back in the building? And it was all, and I'm just like, hey, Charlie, what'd you come on?
The people who asked me to leave aren't here
anymore. Yeah, of course. He's made a transition out of radio. Out is the AM dial, and in is the digital. Digital, of course, a fancy word for podcasting, but Charlie's all about audio now. Radio is a thing of the past. Charlie Meyerson's the vice president of editorial at Rivet Radio. He's also supervising a workshop on podcasting Wednesday morning for Chicago's Public Narrative, which used to be Community News.
Community Media Workshop,
former name, right.
The people who give out the Studs Terkel Award,
right,
which will happen coming soon.
That's right, Richard Steele. That's at Columbia College, and delivering a keynote speech on the subject March 29th for the Graduate School at Northwestern University in Evanston. Charlie, great to see you, man.
It's great to be also to see you, too.
I mean, we could talk for hours about this subject because we both have been in this business long enough to be at that symposium about the future of radio, the future of audio, but audio has become the buzzword. It's not radio anymore, it's audio.
Well, and I still call it radio. I think we all still call it radio. The company I work for is called Rivet Radio, and although it's not sent to people over AM and FM transmitters and tall towers, it does come to you through the air, to your smartphone or your computer, not so much over the air to your computer, but over the air to your smartphones.
Sure.
The interesting thing is, and I think you and I both lived through this evolution of the media landscape in the early 2000s, the internet grew very quickly from being able to handle just text and then photos to being able to accommodate video.
Right.
They forgot about audio.
There was
a point at which anyone working for any media organization anywhere in the world that had a web presence, and now that's just about everybody, heard from the boss get us video. Right. We got to have video because they could sell ads against it.
And I was going to say, I mean, there had been experiments in audio. There'd been, you know, Audible being one. I'm trying to think of some others.
Well, Audible started. I remember Audible getting cassettes from Audible.
And, you know? And even SoundCloud, which is still active today. But there was this move to create an audio playground on the internet. And what was missing was people making audio. It wasn't there. But as that's one of the things we're going to talk about is you're seeing more and more people, different, even a younger generation, generations coming out that audio is something that they want to make, and they're making it abundantly.
Well, and the amazing thing to those of us who are old enough, you may be old enough, I'm not sure, to remember the days of reel-to-reel tape recorders and razor blades and splicing tape. And I go back to a time when cut and paste were not menu items on computer screens because nobody had computer screens when I was doing newscasts. If you wanted to change the order of paragraphs in a script, you know, I kept a reel of tape, scotch tape, adhesive tape, and a pair of scissors at my desk alongside my typewriter. So if I wanted to make a last-minute change in the order of paragraphs, I could cut them all up and tape them all back on a page in the right order. So now that same transformation that we've all gotten used to in word processing is available for free to people for audio processing.
And that's really why. I mean, the ability to edit your own audio on it comes in some cases, some computers, it's already there. I mean, that software comes with the computer. So it just gives you an opportunity almost automatic to have the skills that you and I both were cutting. We're doing razor blades again and taking the white piece of the white chalk and be like,
wager almost any young person who's had any computer training at all by middle school or the beginning of high school is familiar now with GarageBand, which is, you know, comes with Apple computers, lets you edit sound very easily.
Now here's
and you can do it on your phone now too. There are apps that will let you edit audio right on your phone.
Trim on the video and phone from when you use the your phone.
Exactly.
Your photos. Okay. That being said, are you seeing, as someone who's is immersed in a startup at Rivet, you're immersed in audio, that's what you have to do. Are you seeing people doing interesting things with it? Are you seeing journalists and content creators making things that we've never seen before? Or is this just a medium to do the same thing that you and I are doing right now?
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing. And as a matter of fact, I was looking over today the guest list for this seminar I'm leading on Wednesday. The people who've signed up for this, and by the way, you can sign up until 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon at publicnarrative.org for this session Wednesday. The people who signed up, they represent a major professional organization that has, you know, hundreds of thousands of members, and they're publishing web and, to some extent, audio content. A major insurance company is sending a contingent of people in. Everyone's looking around with the same enthusiasm they used to look at, you know, 10 years ago and say, video.
Right.
Now, audio is increasingly accessible, and here are some of the things that have transformed it and made that more popular. The phone. There are more people walking around now with headsets in their ears than ever before.
I'm carrying my computer with me, right?
Exactly. And they're listening more than ever before because, you know, again, 20, 30 years ago, portable headsets were not even a thing.
Right.
So now they're listening, and increasingly, young people in particular, when they get in the car, what's the first thing they do? If the car doesn't already have internet, they plug in their phone.
I was going to say, turn in their electronic cigarette?
I was talking to some high school students at a high school journalism. No, I hope they're not doing that. High school journalism conference last week, and I said, what do you do when you get in the car? And several of them said, the first thing they say is, who's got the aux cable?
Yeah, right.
The auxiliary input cable.
That's an old car.
That's an old car.
Every day it changes. If you go right now and get a new Honda CR-V right now, there's no aux table.
You can get Bluetooth.
It's Bluetooth. It's everything in between.
But that's what young people are doing. So there is an audience for this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The major news organizations, with the exception of those that have historically been in radio, and I'm talking mainly public radio, which has embraced the podcast, the sort of non-linear content. It's available when you want it as opposed to when it goes over the air, you know, have not done much. WGN has a vibrant set of podcasts, which, by the way, you can hear on Rivet Radio, the free app you can download.
WGN
for
Plus.
WGN Plus.
I mean, there's some tremendous stuff coming out
there
of that.
There absolutely is. And it's freed of the tyranny of the clock, I like to say. It doesn't have to fit into as some stations do, an 8-minute hole because traffic and weather have to come every few minutes. Well, or, and it doesn't have to be stretched, as you're probably going to do with my interview, to fill a whole half hour. If I get boring in a podcast, you can just kick me out and you're done with me.
Charlie Meyerson. He's the vice president of editorial at Rivet Radio. All right. And he's got his workshop at Columbia College as part of the Chicago's public narrative on Wednesday. You can sign up till 3 o'clock tomorrow. Let's take a break because, you know, that's part of the future. It's a wave of the future. It's breaks.
Absolutely.
Breaks. We'll come back more with Charlie. Stay with us. My guest tonight, Charlie Meyerson. In the hot seat, talking digital media.
Oh, is this heated?
It's heated. It's
I didn't
heated.
Know
they're
that.
Brand new chairs. They're really nice. here on the download, we are talking about the future of media, but we're really focusing on audio. You do your vice president of editorial over at Rivet Radio.
Yes, a vice president at last. The
at
title
last.
I've
you
always
finally,
coveted.
Finally, now I've known you going. So long, and all you've done is you've just complained about when am I going to be a vice president. Well, you got it. How's your life?
It's good. It's okay.
All right, so let me ask you, you know, because we're talking about this, and I've been in these conversations about the sunsetting of radio. Like, I get a lot of people who will say, I've been in different meetings where like, what are we doing about the future? We need to really gear towards the web because radio's not going to be around. And then you'll see on the other side, the piece that'll come out tomorrow that will say, you know what, new study out, AM radio, FM radio, they are up a lot higher than ever.
You know, there are some numbers. There's some startling numbers. There's a company called Edison Research that every year does a report called The Infinite Dial. And they take a look at how Americans are listening to things. And there's some startling numbers here. This is just from, I think, last week or the week before. In-home ownership of over-the-air radio receivers, right. AM and FM, has gone way down.
There are
I
like
think they use the word plummeted.
Still have a radio.
79% of respondents have a radio at home now. A radio of some sort, AM or FM. That number was 96 8 years ago, down to 79.
But that's not that startling to me.
Well, it's not that startling, and I want to be optimistic about
this.
Because
I can listen to WGN radio on
my
phone.
Exactly. That's why I don't think this is the death of radio. It's people love listening to things. Now, you can make a case that once we get self-driving cars and people have the option to take their eyes off the road, you'll be seeing a lot more people watching Netflix in the cars than listening to radio.
Right,
but
right.
For now, at least, they're listening to stuff. And how the sound gets to them is, in the long run, immaterial, whether it's an AM transmitter, an FM transmitter, or their smartphone plugged in by Bluetooth. And I think that's exciting. People love listening to things.
Okay, so there's one thing about the pattern of what people are listening to. And on the other side of the dime, you've got user-generated content. And this is the buzzword that's been around. It's been shiver like UCG. And the idea of people at home being able to make, we talked about it, so easy now to make audio, but there are people at home are making audio, and that's the way, the YouTube of radio, that's how we're going to use radio. And I have been in meetings, and I have been at big boardrooms and big advertising places, and they're like, that's the future. And I'm like, no, it's not. Because I don't believe that people want to hear what their neighbor has to say.
Look, it depends on the neighbor, of course. I have some very
right.
wonderful neighbors,
right.
and I think some of them are listening now, so I'd be delighted to listen to their podcast. Just, you know, and if I need to borrow sugar, please don't slam the door in
right,
my face.
Right.
But you can't turn thumbs down on user-generated content without taking a look at what's become a primary source, and for young people, the number one source of listening for new music now. Guess what that is?
SoundCloud.
YouTube.
Yeah, I get it. I get
YouTube
it. I get it. Yeah.
Began as and is still fundamentally user-generated
right.
content. Now, is a
yeah,
lot of it crap?
Listen,
yes,
yeah,
a lot of it is crap.
They're not listening to you in your garage. They're not like,
no.
Charlie's got
but
a new song.
It's Justin
please
Bieber.
Say Bieber. Yeah,
yeah,
I was going to say
Justin
you can't
Bieber.
Find it.
Yeah, I couldn't find it. I was wondering. Well, I went to Justin and then, no. Wait,
you know, the
good.
New kids
Justin
are listening
Kaufman
to that.
Bieber.
Justin, what's his name?
you know, talk about user-generated content. I often think about Tavi Gevinson, style rookie, blogger, multimedia sensation, started in her bedroom on YouTube.
I find that to be not user-generated content.
They were all users
yeah,
at one point, and they generated content.
And you can make an argument that John Green and his brother
exactly.
are the same concept. But, you know, knowing those people. In any form, if you just look into their story, they're at the same level as some of the you know, sort of up and coming professionals that are in radio, that are in TV. They're personalities, they're stars.
Yes,
they're going to be stars regardless. Cream rises to the top. I don't believe that I'm like, I want to hear what everybody in Michigan Avenue is I want to hear everybody's podcast.
Was Sony Pictures right knocking at their door? was CBS television knocking at their door. They were discovered because of the mechanism of people finding user-generated content, liking it. And so is all of it good? No. Is some of it good? And can we, as a culture, you know, through our educational programs in the schools and high schools and colleges, teach people to write better, to edit videos? If you know any high school kids, they're doing some amazing stuff, again, because they have access to this cheap equipment in the classroom. They are doing some wonderful things just about anywhere.
Let me ask you though, Charlie, this is the one thing that, you know, I'm trying to draw a comparison. I think of like sports. Everybody plays basketball.
Right? Well, I'm not very good at basketball.
You did at one point.
Yes, and
in high school,
never very
you
well.
Probably played on the playground by your house, whatever it was, and you were terrible. But you played it, right?
I'll disagree, but let's pretend that I did. Go ahead.
So you played it and played it and played it, and some got good, and when they got to a certain point, they started to get training. Maybe they played in a high school and a coach taught them how to run back and forth better and to draw the plays. And then because of that training, they moved on to college and there was some training. And any of those players that went to the National Basketball Association, it was because they continued their training to get there. Do you see a world in which there's going to be enough audio training for these people who are really good and maybe they got a great voice, but they need to go to the next level? What's the next level for a kid who's making audio in their basement?
Well, you know, a good education, going to a good school,
projects? I mean, Columbia College does radio.
Mm-hmm.
Are you seeing at Northwestern and other places saying now we've got an audio department?
You know, to my surprise, Northwestern's invited me to deliver a keynote address, and it's actually going to be directed largely at people on in the technical academic field at Northwestern, who have their own podcasts and who want to learn to get better. I'm not going to be talking to Medill, which is the journalism school where I've taught on occasion too. But this is for others. So, yeah. That's the short answer.
But that's what needs to happen. In my mind,
and practice makes perfect. Yeah, doing, I mean, you know as well as I do, most of us when we started radio weren't very good, and just doing it day in and day out, putting the headphones on, talking into the microphone, and if you go back, if you're really good, you go back and listen to how bad you sounded, and then you take yourself apart, and then ideally you're better the next day. So there's a feedback loop built into, you know, the recording process for those who go back and listen and say, oh, I could have done that better.
Now, we mentioned the two components, the idea of somebody making something, somebody consuming it. But the third part is people making money off of it. And that's the part that's still missing. Advertisers coming to audio. And you see it a little bit with podcast successes like Serial, mm-hmm, or others where they're actually doing it. But that's few and far between. The percentages are pretty, I mean, that's not a good percentage.
Well,
Serial's
but there are,
getting paid and everybody else isn't.
As with Google's AdSense program where, you know, even, you know, the most modest blogger, if he or she gets enough people to come to their page, gets a few bucks from Google for ads served on their page. That's going to happen with audio. I have no doubt. It's already beginning to happen. And for those who wind up with an unusually large audience, yeah, there's money to be made. And it's money that, you know, in many cases, they won't be splitting with a giant CBS conglomerate, which, by the way, is up for sale. If anyone wants to buy CBS Radio, I think they're
anybody,
on the market
right
now.
How about that Justin, what's his name? Bieber.
Bieber. Yeah, that's right. Can I make one other point?
Yes.
Here's something interesting that we're learning at Rivet. For every piece of content that we play on Rivet, every individual news story, every WGN podcast, the WGN Plus audio segment that we play, we can look at metrics and say, okay, X number of people started listening to this. Of those people, how many pressed skip in the first 30 seconds. Mm. Someone has compared Rivet to Tinder for radio news. Now, I've never used Tinder. I'm a happily married man, but no. But, you know, you can swipe from one. If you don't like what you're seeing, you can swipe left or right. Same thing with Rivet. We sort of stress test audio because listeners can skip, or if you like it, you can swipe right to go back and listen to it again. But we have metrics. We can say how many people started listening to this, how many people finished listening to this, how many people skipped halfway through, bailed out halfway through. So some patterns are emerging for us because there aren't many organizations that have this kind of data on individual podcasts. So we're learning very quickly what it takes to get people to listen. And as the industry as a whole gets smart like that, we can be smarter about how we place ads and do all the rest.
Charlie Meyerson is the vice president of editorial at Rivet Radio. He'll be supervising a workshop on podcasting Wednesday morning for Chicago's Public Narrative at Columbia College.
Sign up before 3 o'clock
before
tomorrow.
3 o'clock. And he's also delivering a keynote speech on the subject March 29th for the Graduate School at Northwestern University in Evanston. Great to see you, Charlie. And you got to come back when you get some of these analytics in. We can talk about the metrics.
I'm available for weddings and bar mitzvahs. Call anytime.
Oh, there it is, our song. It's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 to play the worst. We're giving away tickets to Harry Connick Jr. in studio with me. Well, I mean, if you're a regular listener, you know this segment. This is where we collectively bemoan and complain about the worst things in our society. For instance, you know what's the worst? The rubber bands that the mailman uses. I have so many rubber bands. I have like 40 rubber bands because that's the technology that the mail uses to bunch my stuff up. You know what? Just put it. It's not a lot of mail. It's junk mail. Just put it in there.
Or do what I do, and I just changed my address, and I don't get any mail.
There's also that.
Man, I mean, my mail's going somewhere, and those rubber bands are happening to somebody, but I don't get them.
I'm the one who gets your rubber bands.
That's right.
All right. You know what's the worst? People who wear aqua shoes. I've done that one before. Aqua, like you go on a vacation, do you wear
Crocs.
Aqua shoes?
Crocs.
Crocs. Do they have an aqua shoe?
Like that was a plug. I was paid to say that.
Yeah, sure.
In studio with me, the co-hosts of the Arts and Culture Podcast, General Admission, Don Hall and Tyler Green. What's up, guys?
Hey, you know, Justin. We're hanging out.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, guys, this is fun.
Your podcast is launching season 5 at the end of this month, mm-hmm. March. Yeah. I'm excited for that. Congratulations.
Thanks. Thank
you. Another season. I'm sure you have choice the worsts for us tonight. And to incentivize you, like we said, we're giving away prizes. We got some free pizzas for second and third place, but first place tonight, Harry Connick Jr., who I believe is playing at Chicago Theater. He's playing at Chicago Theater on May 18th, and we've got a pair of tickets to give away to the best, the worst tonight. 312-981-7200. You can call or you can text, and we will play until about 10:30. Guys, I threw this out to you. You know, I thought at first, I'm like, they're going to have some good stuff about arts and culture. Don probably doesn't have as many the worst. We have a new segment called The Rant.
Yeah. If you gave me The Rant.
His life is
just
the worst.
Put me on the air. Give me an hour. Lock the door. Here it comes. I got a few things. Just right. a few so things I want to say.
Why don't we start with Tyler?
All right.
Tyler, why don't you start tonight? What did you bring for the worst?
I got a few. I'm as angry as Don. I'm just not as loud. So it actually relates to concert tickets, right? So you go to a concert and you get a ticket and it has a time on it. So Aretha Franklin, Chicago Theater, 7:30 p.m. Somebody like me, I'm very OCD. So I get there. My husband's listening right now. I get there at 7. Okay, I'm ready to go. I got my two wines. I'm ready for the show to start. $20 in. And no Aretha at 7:30, no nothing until like 8:15. Then somebody you've never heard of comes out at 8:15, plays for 15 minutes, another hour break, and then finally Aretha comes out at 9:30. You've got a reserved seat for $125. You don't need to get there at 7:30. It is the worst. Just put the time that the artist is going to come out on to the ticket. It is not
all right.
Difficult.
All right.
I like that rant. That's a good rant, Tyler.
He's really angry.
You know what this was prompted
thing.
By was Madonna has been allegedly like 3 hours late for her past like 9 shows on her tour. You know, and that is not the same thing.
Is it because they start late, or is it because there's like 19 opening bands?
It's because you paid $125 and you don't have a freaking choice. You're going to sit there or you're going to eat the cost.
I have to remember what it was, but I there was someone who was a huge ticket, $100 or whatever, and they just came out. There was no opener. They're like, hey, everybody, and they did it, and it was
perfect.
You know
like who it was? Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's a man of the people, and he doesn't care about all sorts of crap.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing. And along that, I think the worst is the fact that you got to pay, you know, like a mortgage on your house or your child's college payment to see. I'm sorry. I'm not paying $100 for a concert ticket unless the Beatles all come back
100?
Alive.
And you guys are old. Because
I think
like,
it's ridiculous. Sorry, that's a ridiculous 100, 100 amount.
100's nothing.
That's why I don't go see concerts, but a bunch of jags.
100 is 400 level at Soldier Field for Beyonce. Like, you're talking $600 for this Madonna show at wherever she was. Brisbane, I think, is where it happened. $600. These people are waiting waiting 3 hours for it to come
we
out.
Just talked, living we just embodiment talked embodiment of Santa Claus came down. I wouldn't pay $100 to see.
We just talked about with Chris Jones about the about the Goodman Theater this summer. Having Patti LuPone, $145 is the average.
It's you know
Don already has his tickets. Don't worry about it.
No, I don't, and I'm not gonna. It's you know it's like Hamilton the musical's coming.
Watch it.
Oh, I have a choice. I can go see Hamilton the musical, or I can buy a freaking Lexus. Those are my choices, and I think, I don't know, maybe I'll just, it drives me nuts.
Really?
312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Let me introduce our partner in crime, Pete Zimmerman.
This is his game.
Yeah. All right, Pete, what do you got for tonight?
Good game.
This is I'm not as angry about this, but this is the worst. When you're on Instagram and you accidentally like a sponsored post.
Oh, that's the worst. I hate that. You know, you're flipping.
Oh, I like Tyler's post. I like Don's. He got me T-Mobile. Hate that.
You're like, oh, cool. Cool.
Cool T-Mobile. Cool.
It's the worst.
Man, that is a really cool New York City nightlife picture where their phone is pink. I'm going to like that. Oh, it's an ad.
It's the worst.
That is the worst.
Getting manipulated at all and liking anything in social media that's a sponsored post is really depressing.
Yeah. I mean, what's Instagram?
Yeah. And actually, Pete, it's actually worse if you're actually going to the bathroom when you like it because you want to rush. You want to go, no, no. And you're on the pot. You can't do anything. You're kind of stuck in, you know, the bidet. It's nothing you can do about it.
There you go.
You have a bidet?
No.
Oh, that's my dream.
But Apple's coming out with one. It's called the iBidet.
iBidet?
Yeah, it'll shoot water up your thing, any place in the house, you just mentally go, hmm. And then boom.
You just say to Siri, bidet?
Bidet.
Siri, bidet now?
Get your Apple Watch on and hold it behind you.
iBidet.
Squirt.
312-981-7200. So I've got a couple here that are very specific, and we got some people calling in, which is good. 847 says, the sound your dog makes when he's cleaning his special place. You like that one, huh?
I love that one, because that's an awful sound. Let's be honest, because there's a discomfort. Because you want to do it. You wish you could be doing that. You know what I mean? And B... But you don't want to make that sound. Yeah.
All right. I also have the worst. When your college, this is 214, it says, when your college roommate pulls a prank on you and replaces your toothpaste with anchovy paste, and you're too drunk to catch it before your whole mouth reeks like a fish tank.
That's fantastic. That's my favorite so far.
If you're that drunk, your mouth smells like a fish tank anyway.
Yeah, probably not a fish tank, but yeah.
Or something bad, something stinky, yeah.
Okay, so let's take a break. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We're playing the worst here on the download. Don Hall and Tyler Green. We're also giving away Harry Connick Jr. tickets for the winner. Second place, we're the ones who got to come up with. We have to pick who's first, second,
all right,
third.
Okay.
So Don, Tyler, so get ready for that. Two pizzas and a Harry Connick Jr. pair of tickets.
All right.
Coming up, it's the worst.
It's going down,
all right, here we are playing the worst on the download. That's every Monday night that we have a show. We have two competent people in studio to help us out. Don Hall and Tyler Green are the competent.
You couldn't find any competent people tonight, so you got
Tyler.
Yeah,
we couldn't find them, but then we found you guys. The co-hosts of the Arts and Culture podcast, General Admission, which is season 5, starts at the end of the month. What's special about this season, guys?
The first episode right out of the gate is my interview with Henry Rollins and Joe Shanahan at the Metro.
It was a blast.
It was a lot of fun. So yeah,
we're picking a new art form for every episode. 12 episodes. So there will only be one theater episode, and you know that's it instead of 12. So it'll be interesting.
All right. We'll talk more about it coming up here. 312-981-7200. The lines are jammed up. So we're going to get to them in just a second. Do you want to take us to another The Worst?
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
To me, it's the worst is when posers use GoFundMe to pay for their vacation or their friggin' rent.
Nice.
I hate that.
People do that?
Oh, like, my God. Yeah. There's a
tons.
It's like, you know, a fairly notable local lit man. I think you've had him on the show before, did a GoFundMe because he couldn't write in his house. So he needed an office space. And so he got a GoFundMe to fund his office space rent. I went, come on. That's not what this is. This is for like starving people in Flint, Michigan. This is not so that you can pay your rent.
I don't think the mission statement of GoFundMe is for starving people in Flint, Michigan.
Yeah, but that's what it's supposed to be. Well, it should be. It should be.
Sure, it's not your company.
This is for the people who can't make money any other way. They do GoFundMe, not, hey, I really want to go to Cancun. It's on my bucket list. Throw in a couple of bucks. I'm like, I want to punch you right in the head. I wow. hate that. That is the worst.
It's a leap. It's a leap.
All right, we got a ton of phone calls. 312-981-7200. Keep them coming to text. We got a lot of stuff to get through. Let's go to Tom. Tom, you're playing the worst. What's the worst, Tom?
I can't believe Adam LaRoche.
Adam LaRoche, the worst?
Yeah, I just can't believe it.
Who's that?
You know how long it takes, like, 50 men that work, like, union wages just to make $13 million? Ooh. He stunk last year. How many of us take their kids to work every day? I mean, I thought maybe this time he'd get his act together and maybe hit some home runs this year for us. That's what he's getting paid for.
Right.
I mean, why does everybody come to Sox and they crap out? I mean, $13 million, and he's walking away. Are you kidding me?
I hear you, Tom.
I mean, gee whiz, man!
I don't want to break the awesome tension that you built on how you got angrier as the rant went on.
Well, I'm letting you know right now. You know, it's a lot of money. You remember you take your kid to work?
Yeah.
I used to ask. I had a daughter. I brought. I had to, because it was take your son to work. I asked permission to bring my daughter to work that day. You know,
yeah.
When I worked for Misusa, and it's just crazy. I can't believe this is going on. Right. I mean, that man.
I know.
Gee whiz, man. You know, what do you want from us? We're Sox fans. He stunk last year. He got a great contract for 2 years. I was hoping this year maybe, hey, come on. And then all of a sudden, his child. Hey, I'm not against kids coming to work. My dad took me to work all the time when we were for Martin Oil. But come on, you know, it's terrible. Right.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for that. That's,
I mean, Tyler and I don't know anything about sports.
Wait, slow down.
At all.
Who do you work for?
Yeah. No, but Tyler and I don't know anything about sports at all. But I'm telling you, the passion was a seller.
Tom nailed it because he started with Adam LaRoche is the White Sox player who retired because his boss said to him, you can't bring your kid to work every day.
Oh, okay. I did read about it. Okay, story. I read about that. Okay, I read
and
about
so
that.
So Tom's mad, and that's what he was doing this thing. And what I really liked about Tom was the flow. I mean, he had that down. He got angrier and angrier as it went on.
Yeah. What was Matutsa? What was that?
I don't know. That's where he worked.
That's where he worked. He worked for Matutsa. Yeah.
Who doesn't? I
mean, and Martin Oil.
Why you got to ask so many questions?
Yeah, what is your problem?
He said he worked for Matutsa.
That wasn't part of the rant.
Curious, man.
Let's keep going. Let's
side piece of information.
Let's go to Sarah. Sarah, you are on the worst. Sarah, what's the worst?
I'm a terrible person for saying this. I'm embarrassed, but it's true. When you're at a store and the lines are packed and you get done and your bill, whatever, and then they say, would you like to donate $1 for the poor kids or cancer or whatever it is? And it's like all this pressure. Everyone's looking at you like, is she going to donate or is she like a complete... whatever, you know? It's so, then you can't win.
You're either
like giving money or you're a total jerk and everyone knows it.
Love it, Sarah. Love it.
The only thing I want to tell Sarah is, Sarah, the thing about it is you don't know those people. And so next time you're in that line and they say, would you like to donate to Kansas? I just want you to scream in a really bad English accent, bah, humbug, and then throw something and then take your groceries away.
Do you guys have that? Do you ever give money at the checkout?
Yeah. I go to Whole Foods. They say, do you want to round up? I say, yeah. I mean, it's just easy to say that. I like even numbers.
I like Sarah's honesty because I agree. There are times where I'm always like, I knee jerk to no because I think everything in life is a scam. So like, I'm automatic. I'm like, no.
Nope.
Before you even finish, no. And they're like, but it's, I don't care. No.
Well, you know, I believe that empathy in some ways is a way to end the world. If you really want to donate, you don't donate a whole bunch of little amounts to, because a lot of right. these nonprofits, it costs them more to process your payment. So you take a large sum and you give it to something that actually matters, not a dollar.
Yeah, but what if a bunch of Easter Seals kids or whatever it is? But what if a bunch of people round up 50 cents at Whole Foods in a day and that ends up being
$3,000? Do you really trust Whole Foods? Do you really trust them?
Here we go.
I don't. All right, let's do Susan.
Susan, what's the worst, Susan?
Going on a job interview, having a great interview, and then shaking the hands of the person that interviewed you and turning around to exit and walking into a glass wall.
Oh, yes.
That is the worst. That is the worst.
Susan, you got to hang in this game. That's great. I'm going to keep you on hold. That's a good one. Oh, Susan.
Yeah, that's good.
You just reminded me of a time when I was in Barcelona, or should I say Barcelona, and I was
not
a young
boy.
Not
if you don't want me to shove you in the locker.
I was 18 years old, I think, on study abroad, and we were at this place called Chupitos, which I believe means shot, and it was a shot bar, and they had this like menu of 100 shots, and this woman was the bartender. We just kept getting drunker and drunker. Harry Potter was one of the shots, and she was like, I've got this mysterious shot. You don't want it. All night, I was like, I want this shot. And so finally, at the end of the night, she's like, I convince her to give me the shot. So it's me and my friend Justin, a different Justin, and she puts these military helmets on us and says it's called the Revolution. And then she gets these plastic guns out, starts hitting us on the head with them, and lighting our shots on fire, has every alcohol in it. And she's so happy, and I'm so happy, and I turn around and I ran into a glass wall, and I have a scar right here on my
nose.
Did
you break the...
I didn't break it, but it was not a good moment in my life.
You're like a drunken pigeon.
Let's do one more before we go to the break to the news. Let's go to Ray. Ray, what's the worst, Ray?
The worst is when a business offers free Wi-Fi and you can't even dial up anything. You can't Google or search for anything because it's so bad.
Yeah. You know what one I don't like is when you're like, oh, it's Wi-Fi, and then you are like, great, and then you turn on your browser and it goes to their page and they're like, hey, we're they do this where I get my car serviced.
Yeah.
And then you're not even sure what you can do at that point. Like, maybe I got to pay. It's like what they do on the airlines. I hate that stuff.
Yeah. It's just, if you're going to give free Wi-Fi, give free Wi-Fi. Make it decent Wi-Fi.
Are you honestly losing money by not offering free Wi-Fi? Yeah, I mean, talk about scamming the scam.
Just trying to squeeze every dime out of you. Yeah. And if I know Ray, and I think I know Ray, Ray doesn't have a dime to squeeze.
Right.
So, you know, he wants good Wi-Fi.
Ray, that's pretty much what this is about, right?
Well, what I'm saying is that it winds up being it's supposed to be a benefit, and it winds up making you think negative of them.
Yeah, right. You know? You're right. So that's like a marketing opportunity that gone awry.
It's like, here's this free thing, but first I'm going to kick you in the nuts.
Don Hall and Tyler Green.
No, just cool. Don Hall. No, I do not endorse
Tyler
that
wants
statement.
Out. Yeah. These guys are the co-hosts of General Admission. The podcast season 5 begins at the end of March. We'll talk more about that. But also the worst, 312-981-7200. Keep them coming. Harry Connick Jr. tickets are on the line. Stay with us.
It's going down, y'all.
It's a download here on WGN Radio, 10 o'clock, 10:10. We're playing the worst. We'll play for another, I guess, for another 10 or so minutes, and then we'll pick the winners. Tonight, we're giving away 2 Lou Malnati's gift certificates and the number one prize, tickets to Harry Connick Jr. It's going to be at the Chicago Theater on May 18th. Don Hall, Tyler Green.
Yep.
They're the co-hosts of the podcast, the Arts and Culture Podcast, General Admission, which season 5 begins at the end of March. Where do people find it?
GeneralAdmissionChicago.com.
Oh, a website.
It's a website.
It's so old. That's so
old. It's old school,
my friend. Alternatively, geocities.com/gx42/generaladmission.html.
All right, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. I have a ton of texts to get through, and we're going to get through them in just a second. I wanted to go to Twitter. Claire's got a great one on Twitter. When you take the time to lovingly heat up a lean cuisine for your kid for dinner, and he's, for some reason, ungrateful. That's great. Zim, what do you got? You got another one?
Sure. The worst is when you're driving on a main street, say like Clark Street up in Andersonville, and there's the crosswalk, and there's a little sign, stop sign, for people in the crosswalk, but people that stop at that stop sign when nobody is in the crosswalk.
What? They do that?
Oh, yeah.
That's the worst. Yeah. So people who are driving, there's nobody there to cross, and they stop anyway at a crosswalk?
Exactly.
That's that's ridiculously unsafe.
It's the law, isn't it?
No, it's not. There has to be somebody in the crosswalk.
There got to be people in the crosswalk. The thing about it is you got to read that, though. Right. That's the thing. It's like, let's put a sign in the middle of the road that people have to stop and read to know whether they have to stop and read it. That's ridiculous.
You know what's also the worst?
What's the worst?
I experienced this on Clark Street. You just reminded me this weekend. Walking down the street, just trying to enjoy your day. Girl Scout cookies on the corner. You walk by, you have to buy the Girl Scout cookies. You can't walk past the Girl Scouts and not buy the cookies. So now we have, you know, 6 boxes of Girl Scout cookies sitting at home.
Oh, that sounds good.
Hey, I had a Girl Scout.
Actually, that's not too bad.
I had a Girl Scout. I had the Girl Scout saying, hey, will you buy ticket? And I said, no. And she got the disappointed look on her and said, hey, there's a glass ceiling. You need to get used to disappointment.
Wow.
Yeah.
He's such a jerk. Such a mean person. When I can't stand back to crosswalk, the worst is when, and this happens a lot on Randolph Street, you'll get to a certain point where they get up to the crosswalk and they'll start looking at their phone. And you roll up as a driver and you slow down to let them go. And a lot of traffic still hasn't figured out whether or not everybody's going to do that or not. So people are kind of almost like slamming on their brakes because you stopped and they don't go.
Yeah, they wave you.
They wave you on. Yeah, they're like, dude, I just stopped, man. Yeah. Roll out. And please justify my stop.
Mm-hmm. What if they don't have to cross the street?
No, they aren't crossing the street. Oh. They're just old school Chicagoans like myself who will wait till all the traffic's gone.
There you go.
But I stop for them. The law tells me to. And they're like, no, keep going. I'll wait till you're passed. And I'm like, no, it doesn't work that way.
I think this is the centerpiece of all of Chicago's political and social issues right here.
It really is. We figured it out.
So mad about right. Pedestrians and drivers get so mad about this very thing.
And then you throw in the bicyclists, and then it's chaos, my friends.
They don't even date now.
There's anger and
rage.
Not
even going to Uber.
All right, let's get through some of these texts because people text in. 815, the worst is driving 18 hours to a music festival to only have the first day completely rained out. That does suck.
That's the worst.
563, the worst is not being able to win the worst because I live in Iowa. 815, going to vote in the primary. When quietly asked which party, I whisper Democrat. The man loudly repeats the same to the next person and the next person. 5 total Democrat. Pretty soon, pretty sure it's still echoing through the halls of the VFW.
Wait, can I interrupt you really quick? Uh-huh. I have a Democrat political thing. Feel the burn, okay? Listen. Bernie Sanders is awesome. Love it. Great. Good job. Feel the burn, though? Really? We couldn't have done better than that?
Yeah, that's stupid.
Feel the burn, Don. Could we just say go Sanders?
No, I like feel the burn because Bernie, what it does is that, first Bernie of all, it says life. Bernie Sanders, but it also says
but it sounds like
STD.
An STD.
Yeah, whoa. And it says STD, so all of a sudden Bernie is like way more hip than a 72-year-old
man. Yeah, he's going for the
19-year-old.
Just saying,
I mean, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, feel the burn. It suddenly makes gonorrhea, like, exciting.
A political platform.
That's right.
630's got one. Your son, this is getting into it. Your son gets a free ride to an in-state college, and your wife wants him to go to out-of-state school, $40,000 a semester, and
God.
He agrees.
Wow.
$40,000.
Or we'll see. He could either go to school or he could buy a ticket to Beyonce. It's either one. One or the other.
630 says when you throw a fat, juicy steak on the grill, go check a few minutes later and you found out you ran out of propane.
Just put it in the microwave. It's fine.
What?
Yeah, right.
Oh, man.
84815 says when you're driving and two cars in front of you in the left and right lane have matched speeds and you can't get around them. All right, let's go to the calls. I want to get to Kaner. Kaner, what's the worst, Kaner?
Hey, this is Kaner. I tell you, it drives me nuts when I'm holding the door for someone at Starbucks, and not only do they not say thank you, but they then cut in front of me in line and don't realize that because I was doing a nice gesture for them, now I got to wait longer.
That's terrible. That is the worst. But,
that's the worst. Yeah, it's the worst. And, you know, yeah. Yeah. I don't even have a riff on that because
no Kaner.
That's raw. That's raw. You know,
yeah,
it's like when
does,
you do
a
nice
bad
thing.
Deal.
Well, you know what's actually what's the worst about the holding the door? It's like when you go someplace and you hold the door for one person, and then the next person comes through, and then all of a sudden you've got
you
a string,
like 7 or 8.
And all of a sudden you're the doorman, and you know everybody's like very nice, but there's like 19 people walking through the door, and you're like, whoa, am I Somebody tip me. What?
773's got you call an insurance company and stay on hold for 20 minutes. Only find out you called the wrong number and you get transferred to the right number. Hold for another 20 minutes. You get the line cut and it gets hung up. You call again the wrong number because you get into the right number. You stay on hold again, but your question answered in less than 5 minutes. Your hold time was longer than talking to the customer service agent. That's the worst.
That is the worst.
That was a long text.
Yeah, yeah.
773 says the worst when you trip in public and try to play it off like nothing happened. Then you silently hear someone giggling when you and you start to feel embarrassed.
Yeah, yeah.
Happens to me like almost every day.
That's like when you fart in an elevator. You go, oh, you look around. You look around. Like you look at each, look at everybody like, did you do that? Yeah, yeah.
847, this might be the my winner. This might be my winner, 847. You know what's the worst? When you text your 15-year-old daughter happy birthday and she just ignores it.
Love that. Oh, that's so terrible.
It's the worst, but that's kind of what 15-year-olds do.
It is. That's the worst. 815 says worse is being in the 815 area code in Stockton, Illinois, and trying to call a contest line for years and years. Never once getting through. Never once. The worst. Well,
that
I read
is
it.
The worst.
So there you go. See text. 847, the worst is buying a new car, parking in a parking lot, getting hit.
Hey.
While you're in the store, then going to trade it in to find out you're worth $4,000 less because you have an accident on your history report. That just sounds terrible.
It is rough.
All right, let's do these calls and then we'll take a break and we'll come back and do the wins. Let's do the Tim. Tim, what's the worst, Tim?
The worst is you're preparing for a really big breakfast. You got your big bowl of Captain Crunch and you're ready to dive in. You got your newspaper and you open the fridge. And there's no milk.
That's a traditional worst.
Yeah.
Right?
I like
thanks,
that
Tim.
One.
Thanks,
yeah.
Thanks, Tim. Let's go to Pam. Pam, what's the worst?
The worst is, because I'm a good citizen, good driver, you pull over for the pedestrian and you wave them on. And they're like, no, you go. And then they're giving me the finger. You know, you go. trying to be a lady, but that's a kind of a assault.
They give
insult.
You the
it
finger?
Usually doesn't what? Happen, but I'm one of those that'll go, you go, and I'm a good driver, but when you got a pedestrian standing there going, you go, and then they're giving me the finger.
That's crazy.
You go! So, that upsets me.
Thank you, Pam. Thanks for that.
Are you a Harry Connick Jr. fan, Pam?
There you go.
Pretty good. All right, we'll take a break here. 312-981-7200. We'll come back and we will give away third prize, Lou Malnati's. Second prize, Lou Malnati's. First prize, Harry Connick Jr. at the Chicago Theater. It's a download. The worst. Stay with us.
It's going down, y'all. The worst for my people should come first. You know the deal. The worst come the worst. When worst come the worst for my people should come first.
It's a download. It's the worst. It's Monday night. WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Don Hall, Tyler Green, Pete Zimmerman. We're playing the worst tonight. These guys are the co-hosts of the podcast General Admission, the Arts and Culture Podcast, Season 5, beginning the end of March. You know, we're about to crown the champs.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But before we do that, what did we leave? I mean, did you guys have more, the worst that you wanted to throw out?
I had one. I was feeling a little emotional about it today, and I just wanted to share. I am an anxiety-ridden and stricken, not ridden, stricken human, and I like to look for things to calm anxiety. And my good friend Don here likes to make fun of me, and so particularly for the usage of pharmaceuticals prescribed.
Well, I just say you want to calm down, work out or
yeah,
something.
So right, then right, today, day, I got some
something.
Essential oils from Nordstrom's. Granted, they were $20 for
essential
something.
Oils.
Let me finish for something the size of my pinky. Essential so granted, oils. That's the worst. But also the worst is the fact that I went for something natural, and he still found something wrong with it. It's the worst when your friends don't support your efforts
oils.
To well-being.
No, this yeah. is the thing. This is the thing. Is he got
last
advice?
Word,
he got always. Advice from a woman in her office who is every bit as stressed out as he is on a regular basis. And I'm thinking, you don't go to the person who's stressed out and say, "Hey, what's a good de-stressor?" You go to the person that's not stressed out and say, "What's a good de-stressor?" And she said, "Get this freaking oil that you put on your scalp." It's like, you got to be kidding me! And he paid $20 for like a thimble of it. And then immediately started rolling it on his head. And I went, you know, right. I'm sorry.
It helped.
It did not help.
It did.
It didn't.
Not right. as much
it just
as
made you smell like lavender. You smelled like lavender and peppermint oil for about 2 days.
All right, 630 says, you know what's the worst? Lifted pickup trucks that will never see an unpaved road. That's true.
That is true.
Let's see what we have here. The worst is, I don't think this has ever happened in history. Maybe it has. 630 says, the worst is when you take a Viagra and then you get in a fight with your spouse before you get busy. Yeah, it seems like it kind of, now you're writing jokes, right?
I think you're working hard for that one.
You're working hard for that one.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's, you know.
815, and this is a good place to stop, and then we'll get into the top three. 815 says, when you waved at somebody because you thought they waved at you, only to find out they were waving at somebody else.
Yeah,
that's a tradition. We had a lot of traditionalists tonight.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the no milk in the fridge, that's the worst.
That is the worst.
Tripping on the sidewalk, the worst.
Yep. Actually the worst.
The both sound your dog makes when they're licking themselves, the worst.
That is the worst. I mean, it really is the worst.
Horrible. Horrible.
You know, when you're on a first date and the dog's humping her leg, that's the worst.
Well, I had the worst. One time I was on a first date, this is a long time ago, and my roommate had a dog. It was an old dog. And I brought the girl home, and no one was home except that dog. And the dog just decided at that point, first time I'd ever done that, to empty its faculties, pee and number two, in a sort of like, I'm helpless kind of way, like right by the door. And I'm like, well, welcome to my house.
Hello.
It is the worst. That's the worst. My dog. I'm the like, dog, this dog
the here. Worst dog story. I've got a friend of mine that teaches in Chicago Public Schools. He was helping a guy move, helping his guy and his wife, and it's raining. It's a terrible day. And he's the only guy that showed up to help him move. There's this little yap dog, and the yap dog is biting at his ankles while they're trying to carry these heavy bureaus and stuff. And he looks over, and he says, if you don't put this dog in a room, I'm going to kill it. And they leave the dog out, and at one point, this is a true story.
No, he did not.
He just kind of, and but the thing is, the way he does it, he didn't kick hard, but he kicked the dog. It snapped its neck, and nobody else was there. They had like another 2.5 hours of moving that they had to do.
That's the worst.
So they continued to move stuff while the wife is wailing in the
get
kitchen.
Get that guy on the phone. He won.
Yeah,
get
that is the worst.
That is the worst. Wow, you brought us down with the final there. Okay, so here's what we're giving away tonight. We're giving away Lou Malnati's gift certificates. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumelnatis.com. And we're giving away as the number one prize a pair of tickets to an evening with Harry Connick Jr. on May 18th at the Chicago Theater, presented by Jam Productions. Tickets are on sale now at the Chicago Theater's box office, Ticketmaster.com, or by calling 800-745-3000. All right, so let's do this. Here's what we have. We have at number three. And this is a fun one. This is a fun one. It was Tom who called in. Who ranted about Adam LaRoche.
Yes.
I don't usually give any of the stuff to topical. Like if it's, I don't like Jay Cutler.
Yeah.
But the way that Tom had elegantly sort of stretched out his argument and got angrier and red-faced.
It was Boghossian. It was almost Boghossian in its approach.
I love.
It was wild.
Theater guys here. You get to love the performance.
And that it's Boghossian. That's kind of genius that you made that connection. I'm actually kind of excited about that.
All right. So that's Tom. Tom who called in with the Adam LaRoche rant will be number three. Number two. Okay. Number two is going to go to another caller, Susan. Susan called in, and she had a great job interview. Everything was going well, and when she turned around, she went smack dab into the glass window, not the door, and did that in front of her potential.
We never found out if she got the job. Right. We wondered if she got the job.
She probably did.
It would be how you stuck the landing on that, you know? I mean, if you hit that glass, it's all in how you recover. If you recover with some grace or some humor, maybe you're getting the job.
That's why you
just look like you just, you know, smacked into some glass and you feel like you're going to die, maybe you're going to lose the
job. That's why Brian Boitano was so successful. He stuck the landing.
Even if you don't, they get up. They get up and they just keep going. Yeah. So Susan and Tom are going to get Lou Malnati's gift certificates. The number one, though, was a texter at 847, and the text is going to get them tickets to Harry Connick Jr. The text is, you text your 15-year-old daughter, happy birthday, and she just ignores it. And Todd is on the line. Todd, you're the winner. That really happened to you, Todd.
Thank you.
That happened to you?
Yes, it did. It happened to me this morning.
Oh, man. It's fresh.
She was on spring break, or she's on spring break. I text her. I figured she was still sleeping. And like 2 hours later, I call her. She still didn't return my call.
Oh, no.
We had a little bit of a spat over the weekend, so she's probably just a little PO'd at me, but whatever.
On a birthday, no less.
Well, you get to see Harry Connick Jr. now.
You should take her. Say, hey, I got
you. No, don't take her. She didn't even say thank you. No, don't take her. Take somebody else's daughter. You know? Just to show her, man.
Todd, congratulations. Stay on the line. Thank you so much for playing tonight. And thanks to everyone, for all the people who text in, and we may not have read your stuff, or you called in and we weren't able to get to you. Thank you so much for playing, participating tonight. We'll do it every Monday night here on The Download. Don Hall, Tyler Green, the podcast, General Admission. You can get it at generalmissionchicago.com.
Correct. Uh-huh.
At the end of March will be the beginning of Season 5, which features an interview with Joe Shanahan, Henry Rollins, and...
More.
Others. Others of note.
I stuck that landing you like Brian Boitano.
Guys, great to see you. Thanks for
Thank
being
you,
here.
Thank you,
man.
Thanks, man.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio here. The Allstate Showcase Meat Wave. Local punk rock trio. They put out an album this past fall called Delusion Moon. They're currently touring the continent with shows coming up in Canada. Meat Wave is Chris Sutter, Joe Gack, and Ryan Wisniak, and they are here in studio. What's up, gentlemen? Good to see you.
Hello. Nice to see you, too.
Thanks for being here, man. This is great. I'm looking forward to your performance. Chris is on the microphone here. Chris, let me ask you, you guys obviously come from, you're doing punk rock music. This is the town. I mean, we've had so many different people from Naked Ray Gun down that have been in this studio. What does it mean to do punk rock in Chicago?
I think it's a really diverse place where, like, there's a bunch of stuff going on. So it's I feel like there's a lot of opportunity for bands to play and meet other bands and see other bands. We see so many bands all the time, so it's really perfect for us.
What got you guys into performing punk rock music? I mean, what was it about this genre of music that drew you to it as musicians?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess that's a good question. It's just, I guess it's just a matter of taste. It's really intense. I like things really loud, and to like really feel it with my body is like the best thing. You know, when it's so loud, that's why I like it.
Let me ask you about the punk rock scene in Chicago, because you know I mentioned at the top. I mean, we've had conversations about the 80s with Naked Ray Gun, and even some of the sort of more alt punk bands that were. Where are some of the bands that were Screeching Weasel? John Jughead
sure.
Pearson's been in here. But what's the scene like today? I mean, where is punk rock setting up shop in Chicago? Empty Bottle? Where's your home?
Bottle's the place, I think, or we think. That's our favorite place to play. That's where I go all the time. They do it right. Just every single aspect of that venue and those people is primo. So I like it there a lot, yeah.
All right, so the recipe for the formula for a good punk rock song, in your opinion? You're a trio. You're already one step up. The punk rock trios are the best.
It's a balance act of not being, having it simple enough and not having it too complicated. I don't know. We're still trying to figure out. I don't think I know.
Meat Wave in studio. What are we going to hear? What's the song we're going to hear here?
This song is called Cosmic Zoo.
Cosmic Zoo. Great. All right. So we're going to hear from now. This is Meat Wave. Chris Sutter, Joe Gack, and Ryan Wisniak. You guys, we'll talk about the record. We'll talk about where you're playing next, all that kind of stuff. Coming up at first, here it is. Meat Wave on WGN Radio.
Place. I love it, man. It's the energy. There we go. The Allstate Showcase Studio, the band Meat Wave. That was a song called Cosmic Zoo. They came off the record Delusional Moon, and these guys just rocked Michigan Avenue. That was good stuff, Bob. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more live music with Chicago punk rockers Meat Wave. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. Justin Kaufman in studio with me, the band Meat Wave, local punk rock trio consisting of Chris Sutter, Joe Gack, and Ryan Wisniak on the drums behind me, which I love, man. I feel it.
He's loud.
I love it.
He's very loud.
Chris, let's talk about, I mean, you guys have seen different band lineups, you know, in your time. Talk about what it takes to keep this band going.
I think we all find the music industry interesting, and I don't know. It's kind of an unspoken thing between us. We don't really get too affectionate or anything like that, or recognize what we're doing. We're just kind of doing it.
You're so having band meetings.
It's
like
working
every 2
well.
Weeks?
No meetings, not yet. So we're doing okay.
How did you guys meet up?
I met Ryan because we play in another band called Truman and His Trophy that I started when I was 15 or 16. So I just met him the first day of band practice, and I saw him play. And Joe has recorded bands for the longest time, and he records us. And so we met doing that in another band.
What's the recording process like? Joe, come sit down. Let me ask you, what's it like, I mean, being a part of the band where you're recording and you're part of it? Producing and actually being in the band. What's that like?
Well, basically what we do is we set up mics and I hit record on the laptop and I run back.
That's it?
And play. I mean, hard drive space is cheap.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's like I'm not too worried about it.
Let me ask you, do you have a particular style when you're putting this stuff together? What would you fashion yourself as when you talk about a music producer?
Well, I try to record the bands like how they sound, pretty much, like what they are, honest.
Yeah.
Like an honest representation of it.
That's what you're going
That's
for.
My thing, kind of.
From you guys' vantage point, the question I have for you is, as a band like this, I mean, how do you bring the song? Does someone come and write the material and you guys all do it together?
Usually I'll bring like a skeleton of the song and to them, or an idea, or just like a little piece of music, and we play that and we kind of sleep on it and take it from there. So that's how it's been going, and we collaborate too.
Back, you guys mentioned this before about Empty Bottle being the spot, but if I'm a punk rock aficionado, I want punk rock in Chicago, where do you go? Where are the places that are showcasing punk rock in Chicago?
I know a lot of shows are happening at Quenchers right now. I always see Quenchers,
yep,
Bar, which is Western and Fullerton.
Maybe the Burlington.
The Burlington's pretty cool, dark place.
Warehouse.
That's about it.
I mean, that's all stuff in our neighborhood. I'm sure there's other stuff going on.
Yeah, and there's always houses, too.
Yeah, there's houses.
That come and go. So, yeah, I don't know if it's spaces.
I grew up in the time when the Fireside Bowl was the place to go to see all this stuff, because that was just, it was like at the height with Brian Peters and those guys.
Right.
Yep. And I've always, I'm naturally curious about where the scene's at now. But Quenchers, I mean, I see that a lot over there.
It's all over the place, really. And we are just, you know, we see like a small part of it. We play in a small part of it, I feel like. There's many parts to
it. All right. Well, let's not rob the late night WGN audience of another punk rock song. What's the name of this one?
This is called Sham King.
Sham King. All right. The band Meat Wave here on WGN Radio Punk Rock. The trio. The song is called, what is it? Sham?
Sham King.
Sham King.
Yes.
Here we go. That's what I needed, man. I'm staying up all night now. The band Meat Wave in studio here in the Allstate Studio on Michigan Avenue. Their latest record was put out in the fall, Delusional Moon.
Delusion Moon.
Sorry about that, guys.
No worries.
And where can we see you next?
Next, we're kind of taking it easy. We're writing a lot. We're going to go on tour this summer. I'm sure we'll be playing in Chicago.
All right.
Before that.
Well, Chris Sutter, Joe Gack, and Ryan Wisniak, thanks so much for being here tonight. Thanks for performing live waking us up here at on the download. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
All right, that's going to do it for the download tonight. Patty Vasquez up next. We're pretty late with Patty Vasquez. We will be off tomorrow for the Blackhawks, but we're back on Wednesday live from Pequod's Pizza up at 2207 North Clybourne.
Coach Doug Bruno is going to be there. He's coaching the Lady Blue Demons to the Sweet 16, the only college winner I know about in the area, right? Mike Fouché will update us on politics, and we'll also do a live Character Flaws. Some actors from Second City will be there to have some fun at Pequod's.